Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ken McKenzie, and on behalf of the executive of the Vancouver Institute, I would like to welcome you to the second of our 1993 spring series of lectures. Institute lectures are open to all without entry fee, but our program is dependent on the financial support of our members. I would urge you to join the Institute if you've not already done so. Membership fees are modest, and they are tax deductible. Before introducing tonight's speaker, may I remind you that next Saturday evening, Professor Carolyn Merchant of the University of California at Berkeley will give a Cecil and Ida Green lecture on the topic Reinventing Nature. Our guest tonight is Dr. Mark Fruin, the director of the Institute of Asian Research at UBC. Dr. Fruin came to UBC last year. He has had a distinguished academic career at a variety of institutions, including the University of California at Los Angeles, the Harvard Graduate School of Business Administration, the University of Tokyo, and the National University of Singapore. He is a graduate of Stanford University with a PhD in Japanese social and economic history. He is the author of numerous articles and several books, including The Japanese Enterprise System, Competitive Strategies and Cooperative Structures, published by Oxford University Press last year. Dr. Fruin is a leading authority on the Japanese approach to management, which of course is becoming increasingly influential far beyond Japan itself. And that is the focus of his lecture tonight. Knowledge-based competition, the Japanese challenge. Dr. Fruin.
Good evening. Thank you very much. It's certainly a pleasure to talk to you tonight about a subject that's very dear to my heart and I think increasingly important one. In fact, I would simply underscore that point by telling you that I just returned today from Los Angeles, where I was at a meeting of the National Research Council, the American National Research Council, which is composed of the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering. And I'm on a group there called the Manufacturing Studies Board, which is basically looking at the use of American government funds at eight different universities in the United States to, in fact, study what we're talking about tonight, industry and technology management in Japan. And the American government has already put about $8 million into this endeavor, and $30 million are scheduled to go into this project in the near future. And I think that simply underscores the importance of learning from Japan and trying to understand the differences with regards to industrial organization and technology management that may characterize the Japanese approach to business. So my subject tonight is knowledge-based competition. And I want to talk about knowledge-based competition in the context of high-tech factories and fast-to-market product strategies. High-tech factories and fast-to-market product strategies. Now, factories are not normally seen as a very glamorous subject. And it's really my task to try to convince you otherwise this evening. In Japan, indeed, factories are usually called today by the so-called three Ks. These three Ks are kiken, kitsui, and kitanai. Kiken means dangerous. Kitsui means difficult. And kitanai means difficult, dirty. So in fact, even in Japan today, factory work is being characterized by these three negative Ks. And I think it's very important, therefore, to understand that we don't have a unanimous opinion in Japan that what's happening in the workplace, what I would call the knowledge-based revolution in the workplace, is in fact universally approved of and understood even in Japan. Now, I want to start off by saying the future of knowledge-based competition hinges on factories, not companies, that accomplish three things. They shorten time to market for products. They produce goods in volume and variety. And they make learning the ultimate organizational ambition. So these three features of knowledge-based competition, I believe, happen primarily in factories. Shorten time to market, produce goods in volume and variety, and make learning the ultimate organizational ambition. Each of these deserves more explanation, and I will explain them a bit more now. Shortening time to market. Originally, we could say that Japan succeeded with what's called fast follower strategies. A fast follower strategy is when you borrow or beg or buy technology or products or manufacturing processes from overseas. You modify and adapt them to fit local circumstances, and then basically you produce look-alike products in much less time than it took the original manufacturer to do so. That's the fast follower strategy. You look abroad, see what there is that's useful to copy or imitate or borrow, and then you speed up the process by which those products or technologies are brought and adapted to local circumstances. Today, however, fast follower strategies are no longer viable, and for two reasons. Number one, Japan has already caught up. There's not very much for Japan to copy anymore from around the world. But just as importantly, I can't seem to quite get this mic in the right location, just as importantly, another reason why fast follower strategies don't work today is that fast follower strategies are not fast enough. And that's because product life cycles have speeded up tremendously in industrial competition today. Let me give you a few examples of why fast follower strategies don't work in a context where product development cycles and product life cycles have speeded up to the degree that they have in Japan today. Casio and Sharp, two large electronics companies in Japan, bring out new radio cassette players, boom boxes, on a cycle of 3 to 4 months. That is, every 3 to 4 months, Casio and Sharp will bring out a new radio cassette player to supplement, or really to introduce a new product which will undermine the existing product in the marketplace. Now, you might say radio cassette players are not a terribly complex product, and as a result, you could get this kind of rapid 3 to 4 month cycle. Another product that I know a great deal about are photocopiers. An average photocopier, if you imagine this to be a photocopier, has about 1,000 different parts and components. Today, in the Japanese marketplace, the average life expectancy for a photocopier is 6 months long. That is, within 6 months, a rival company will bring out a photocopier that will either undercut your photocopier with regards to price or will offer more features for the same price. So 6 month cycle for even a relatively complex product like a photocopier. So we're not simply talking radio cassettes. We're also talking laptop computers, photocopiers, overhead projectors, products with a fair amount of parts and sophisticated technology. I was at the University of Tokyo 2 years ago, and while I was there, I sort of outfitted a home electronics center for myself. Big screen TV, stereo, laser disc player. And on all of these kinds of products, I got at least a 40% discount and as much as a 60% discount over current prices in the Tokyo marketplace 2 years ago. Why at least a 40% and as much as a 60% discount? Because I bought the previous year's model. Right? So big screen TV, stereo components, laser disc players are on a one-year product cycle with regards to their demand and supply in the marketplace in Japan today. Memory chips are basically, as we know, on a 3 to 4 year cycle in Japan. This is the so-called silicon cycle. And every new generation of chip is coming out on this kind of cycle with a high degree of predictability. I'm not talking about new variations on a 386 or 486 chip. I'm talking about moving from 286 to 386 to 486. Moving from 1 megabyte to 4 megabytes to 16 megabyte chips on a 3 to 4 year cycle. Now, let me give you some idea of what that means. A new state-of-the-art IC fabrication facility today requires at least $500 to $600 million investment. $500 to $600 million investment to get a new IC fabrication facility online. And it takes a minimum of 16 to 24 months to erect the facility, to build it. Now, if we're talking about a silicon cycle of 48 months, and you're already 16 to 24 months in building the facility, plus investing the $600 million that it takes to put the facility up, that means you've got 2 years to recover your investment and to make enough money that you can establish a new IC fabrication facility. So that gives you some idea of what the speed up in product life cycles means in Japan. It means a tremendous amount of investment in being first to market. We can see it quite clearly as well in the automobile industry. Japanese automobile companies are bringing new cars to market on roughly a 40-month cycle. 40 months from conception to the introduction of a new vehicle in the marketplace. North American manufacturers are roughly on a 50 to 55 month cycle. European companies are on a 60 month plus cycle. Now, what difference does it make if Japanese companies bring out cars on a 40 month cycle and European manufacturers bring it out on a 60-month cycle? You might be asking yourself that question. But you as a consumer, if you're faced with a choice of buying a 40-month cycle vehicle versus a 60-month cycle vehicle, same price, same level of features, a large, durable good of that sort is one that you want to buy and you want to be assured that it represents state of the art, the latest innovation, the latest safety features, the latest engine management control technology. And of course, if you think about the amount of money that you're investing in this vehicle, you want to get the car, the automobile, that represents the latest in technology. And that's the 40-cycle-month car, 40-month cycle automobile. So if you begin to think about the speed-up in product life cycles and product development cycles that has occurred over the last decade or two, you begin to understand why fast-follower strategies are no longer viable for companies that want to compete globally. And that's certainly the case for Japanese companies. Now, production in volume and variety, the number two feature that I mentioned earlier, is the flip side of being fast to market, or being first to market. Because if you think about being first to market, what that means strategically, if you are too early or too late, if you're too early in the marketplace, no one understands why your product is attractive. Even though you've invested $500 or $600 million, no one has a need for a 486 chip. 386 will do just fine, thank you. Or if you're too late, Intel gets into the marketplace with the 486 chip. AMD gets into the 486 chip market a year or two later. And by then, nobody wants AMD's 486 chip because everyone has become used to Intel's 486 chip. So what I want to suggest is there's a very large risk associated with these rapid product cycles. The risk is you can be too quick to market or too late to market. And that's why production in volume and variety is so important to knowledge-based competition. Because if you produce in variety, that means if one product doesn't do well, if one product is a bomb in the marketplace, you have other products against which you can amortize the costs of the products that are not selling well. So with all of this intense concentration on being first to market, if you have all of your eggs in a basket, a single basket, all of your chips riding on one bet, you better win, you better succeed in the marketplace, or it's what is usually called a bet the company proposition. The company will go bankrupt. So in these extreme knowledge-based competition environments, such as in Japan, companies produce in volume and variety. Now that may not sound all that difficult, but if you can imagine what it takes to focus all of your energy and to coordinate all of your effort to produce a new chip in a 3 to 4 year silicon cycle, imagine all of the additional effort and all of the additional coordination that's required to produce a whole family of IC chips on a 3 to 4 year cycle. So it's very easy to say that production in volume and variety is desirable strategically. It's very difficult, I would argue, to in fact accomplish that feat. And it's because of this difficulty that I will argue very strongly that factories have to play a very important, central role in the coordination of all of the activities which are required in this rapid product cycle competition. And that leads me to my third point, which is the one which says, if you have strategies which emphasize being first to market and producing in volume and variety, obviously learning, knowledge, know-how should be, has to be, the ultimate organizational purpose. And let me remind you, I'm saying that most of this coordination and developmental activity occurs at the factory level, which means that learning at the factory level, learning at the shop floor level, is the pivotal point on which your competitive advantage rests or fails. So in knowledge-based competition in Japan, It's not necessarily big science, big technology products, which produce the winning strategy. It is those strategies executed through firms that are able to mobilize human resources at the factory level where this rapid product development is the key strategy to competitive advantage today. So I'm trying to convince you here that factories are the key competitive assets in knowledge-based competition. And if you are able to realize factories as competitive assets, I think I can convince you of a number of advantages which will accrue. First, you have the capability to commercialize 2 to 3 times as many high-valued added products as your competitors. So if you're able to take full use of what people in factories know, you'll be able to commercialize 2 to 3 times as many high-value-added products as your competitors. You'll be able to incorporate 2 to 3 times as many technologies in your products as your competitors. Any sophisticated high-technology product today is an amalgamation of a number of different technologies. And somehow you've got to have the capabilities to bring those technologies to bear on your product development processes at simultaneously or nearly consecutive amount of time. So if you're able to do this, you get many more technical wrinkles, many more technical capabilities built into your products. You'll be able to bring more high-value-added, technologically complex products to market in less time. Often half the time that it takes rival firms to do so. And finally, if you think of factories as competitive assets, you will be able to develop the capability to compete across the board in commercialization of a variety of new products. Remember, it's production in volume as well as variety. So let me reverse my question to you for a minute and say, how can you compete today unless you have factories with these qualities? Unless you have corporations that are able to mobilize these knowledge-based assets. And in order to illustrate what I think the future of manufacturing looks like, I've collected a few slides, photographic slides, to show you here this evening. These slides are taken of a Japanese factory where I've been doing field work research for about 1 year in this factory. And when I say fieldwork research, I don't necessarily mean with my clipboard and professorial airs. I do a variety of different tasks in the factory, from working on the line to working in the R&D area within the factory, to try to get an overall sense of what's going on in the factory, to try to get a sense of what the social hierarchy is, to try to get an idea of what the pace of work is, to try to get an idea of what is happening in Japanese manufacturing today. So all of these slides will be from this factory where I've spent, as I've said, approximately a year over a 5 to 6 year period. And before I show you these pictures, let me make one important distinction, which is there are those factories in Japan which are more geared towards knowledge-intensive work, development-intensive work, and those which are less oriented in that direction. The factory that I'll show you is clearly one of the former, a factory that's designed for product and process innovation, development-intensive, knowledge-intensive manufacturing. The first question I ask you is, what does this line mean? This is a free throw line on a basketball court. This is the line beyond which you dare not wear your street shoes. You can see a little bit of a street shoe up there in the upper corner of the slide. Because as we know, when you enter a Japanese house, you take your shoes off. This is the line beyond which foreigners are not allowed into the Japanese workplace. What do you think this white line means? Anyone have any bright ideas? This is where you stand when you perform one of the manufacturing tasks. Close, but not quite right. This is a line which is separated from another line by 15 meters, where there's another white line drawn on the floor. And you should cover this distance in 10 seconds. Right? So these are white lines drawn on the floor, the corridor in the factory. And you are asked to pace yourself so that you cover the distance from one line to another line in 10 seconds. Now, this is not an isolated example of what is a general phenomenon in Japan of measuring, evaluating, judging everything that you do, no matter how seemingly insignificant. No, your manager is not standing there with a stopwatch and saying, oh, Fruin, you're going too fast or you're going too slow. There's no one there with a stopwatch. The stopwatch is inside your head. And you are asked to judge yourself, to see how well you conform to the standard which has been set to walk from one white line to the next white line in 10 seconds. And this kind of example really occurs everywhere in the workplace. Everything is standardized. Everything has got a yardstick attached to it. But there's no one telling you how to apply the yardstick. It's up to you to decide how to apply the yardstick, and even if you will apply the yardstick. And this is what the Japanese would call, this is what this one company calls in the yellow box here, Ie no Michi, which is the way of industrial engineering. Now, if you want to be critical, you could say this is Taylorism with a vengeance. Because, in fact, every single thing in the factory has white boxes, yellow boxes, green boxes around it. Everything has measurements. Everything has standards. And in a way, there is a significant legacy of Taylor in the Japanese workplace. What is different, however, is that there is no manager standing over your shoulder saying, do it this way or else. Oops, I see what I did wrong. So this is the entrance to this factory. And again, to give you a sense of all of the messages that are there in the environment. Up at the very top in the green letters, safety first, and the green cross. Then we come down to the red sign, which says, let's create new values. And the white sign says, new spirit. TP stands for total productivity. STEP is total productivity applied to engineering. Quality assurance, value analysis, cost reduction. CD is actually cost down. Now, this is the entranceway to the factory, and you might think that maybe in the entryway these things would be concentrated. But in fact, this kind of display of banners and campaign slogans and all kinds of efforts to enjoin you to greater efforts occurs throughout all the workspace. So once you enter the factory, you enter into an environment which is filled, replete with messages which enjoin you to work harder, to do it better, to do it quicker, to do it cheaper, to do it faster. But again, no one is standing over your shoulder to make sure that you do it quicker, faster, and better. And what I want to impress you with is how there is an effort to control, and really even better than control, manage the workplace environment symbolically, as well as in the content of work, to get people involved, to participate. And I think it's this kind of a workplace which is what we're moving towards if you think about knowledge-based competition. Because knowledge-based competition is getting everybody to do their best, to make use of what they know. And this is, I think, what the future of manufacturing is likely to look like. Pretty prosaic, ordinary-looking factory from the outside. In fact, this factory is old, built in 1935, and it underscores the fact of looking at these buildings here a very important point, which is you can't scrap and rebuild. You can't move from the inner city to the countryside. You don't have that kind of a choice with regards to where you locate your industrial facilities. Land is too valuable to neglect. To neglect a facility like this and let it run downhill. What you have to do is continually renew, rebuild, remodel, restructure the resources that you have. And that's another reason why the environment is filled with these messages enjoining you to work harder. Because we don't have an easy way out. We can't simply decamp from the city and move to the countryside. We're stuck here, and we better make the best uses of the resources that we have. So these are four-story buildings. These are the main manufacturing buildings that you see on the right-hand side of the slide here. They have beautiful, beautiful hardwood oak floors for the top three floors. The whole structure, all the way along, hardwood floors. You can see this is actually an hour from the center of Tokyo. And you still get an idea of what the urban concentration is. And in fact, that urban density and concentration, I think, is a very important element in knowledge-based competition in Japan. There are 26 million people in Greater Tokyo. 26 million people in Greater Tokyo. Highest per capita income in the world. Very well educated population. So you put 26 million sophisticated, well educated, with a high propensity to consume people in the same single market, and you get a sense of how quickly the marketplace may change with regards to what's in fashion, what's desired, what people want. And that's why you've got to have factories like these that can respond with alacrity to those changing market needs. For your information, there's roughly 13 million people in Greater Osaka, which is in western Japan. So out of 127 million people, 40 million people in Japan live in just two markets, Tokyo and Osaka. And that concentration is a very important element, again, in why knowledge-based competition is so advancing so rapidly in Japan. And that environmental circumstance is one that we have to keep in mind when we start thinking about transferability of the Japanese model to other places in the world, because the market circumstances are very different. And maybe this is a good place to put in a plug for UBC Megacities Project and Prad Lakhwian, who's doing just this kind of work on urban density and the effects that it has on things like consumer behavior. This is the photocopier line, and here there's a little display which says this is where you can see the flags up there on the world map. Each pinpoint represents this is where our overseas assembly manufacturing capability resides. These are the places where our products are sent. And these are different types of photocopier models here on display. And basically, they're just considered to be small, medium, size, and large. Although, in fact, if you look at all the different models of small, medium, size, and large photocopier, there are about 40 different models of photocopiers produced in one factory. Production in volume and variety. About 900,000 photocopiers produced a year, 40 different models. That means, for your information, you may have heard about mixed model manufacturing along the same transfer line, along the same assembly belt, comes all of these different models. And the workers have to be sufficiently skilled and motivated to make all of them, which again assumes a high degree of know-how and capability on the part of workers. So flexible manufacturing is not simply an issue for engineers, but it's also an issue for the people who work on the line. Here's what the photocopier line looks like. In fact, I spent a week on this line doing a variety of things, doing the toner subassembly, and then doing some of the final testing and evaluation of the product before it was shipped. Again, you might note the contextual clues in the various banners and signs, which are all across the environment, which basically give people information about standardized work rates, enjoin them to work harder, faster, quicker, the sorts of things that I've already mentioned. Here's a fellow doing some screw assembly, and because there's a little bit of danger associated with this particular task, you can see his workstation is enclosed. But I want you to note on the back wall there, again, you can see about four or five different sorts of posters or banners, slogans, messages, which are trying to manage the environment, manage the workplace. And here you get another idea of some features of Japanese manufacturing. If you look at the rack beyond the photocopier that you see in the lower right-hand section of the screen, you can see a whole series, about 20 different sub-assemblies that are standing up there in the rack. And so you pull those out whenever you need them, and when that trolley begins to get down to the low level, you have a just-in-time card, a kanban, which will then be sent to the parts disbursement place to replace that trolley with a new one. An example of Toyota's just-in-time manufacturing applied to a factory that's primarily making electronics products. Some more scenes of the factories, and again, I simply point out everything is marked, everything is labeled, everything is in its own place. The whole environment is controlled and managed. Similar sort of observation here. Again, you can see the banners and the placards and the various signs that occur throughout the workplace. In the lower left-hand portion of this screen, I just point out here, there's a work, you'll see it in the next slide, but I point out this workstation poster there. What's on that workstation poster? Here I am. Here's my picture, here's my name, here's my job, here's how I do my job. Right? Everything is broken down into steps. Everything is measured, everything is controlled. Well, everything is standardized. The control is self-control. If you think about trying to do the standardization for a factory as complex as this one, 3,300 workers, 13 different product lines, 40 different models of photocopiers alone, it would be a hopeless task to try to do this from the top down. So what you have to do is motivate workers to do it from the bottom up. So this is a worker who defines his job. Not only what it is that he does, over here in the lower left, he says, what is in my heart? You know, what is my wish? To do my job without making any mistakes, without a single miss, without a single defect. And up here on the upper portion of the screen in red, basically he's saying, with my heart motivated to do my best, I will supply products. I'll do my job for the customer. Now, this kind of a slide and this kind of a factory, for those of us in the West, oftentimes raises issue of mind control. You know, how sincere can this really be? Do people really measure the time it takes them to walk 15 meters? Do they really look at their watches and see if they do it in 10 seconds? Do they really mean it when they say that with a sincere heart, I'll do my best to satisfy the customer, to do my job? And this is a key question. Are the high levels of productivity and output that we see in Japan today and the relatively striking increases over time, more than a decade, really now for about three decades, we've seen steady improvement in productivity and increases in manufacturing output in Japan. Is this the result of massive mind control? Or is it the result of workers voluntarily choosing to fully participate in the work process, to invest themselves, their hearts, their heads, their hands in the work process? And that's the question I think you should be asking yourself when you look at these slides. Another example of these environmental messages that are everywhere. And this one simply says, do it this way. If you do it the other way, you're liable to injure yourself, to hurt yourself. And again, all kinds of messages about how to do it right. This is the end of the photocopier line. I kind of like this slide. I mean, I took these slides. I think this one has a little bit of artistic merit. I don't know how you feel with the sunshine and the shadows and the long industrial line. It sort of makes one a little bit romantic about factories, doesn't it? So what we've seen so far maybe fits your preconceptions about what the Japanese workplace is like. Right? Everything spick and span, everything neat, everything ordered, everything standardized, everything done a certain particular way. That's one aspect of the Japanese workplace. Here's another. This is the single largest building at this workplace. 6 stories high, as long as a football field. 1,000 people work in this building. Right. What is this building? The Japanese word for it is, the word that's used at this factory is Gijitsuto, which translates as technology tower. And I call it the Tower of Power. Because right on this factory site, there are 1,000 R&D workers who work right across the street from those 3- and 4-story buildings that I showed you in an earlier slide. So the Tower of Power is juxtaposed to the shop floor. And that's a very important element in knowledge-based competition, because you've got to get the ideas from the lab to the workplace in the quickest, shortest, most efficient, most reliable manner possible. It's only in that way that you can have these ridiculously short product development cycles, which result in these very short product life cycles. So in knowledge-based competition, it's how quickly can you go from the Tower of Power to the shop floor. And it really can't be done any quicker than having 1,000 strong R&D unit, 1,000-man strong R&D unit right next door. I mean, literally, it's not even next door. It's in the same factory compound. Now, here's some of the things that go on in the Tower of Power. This doesn't look very high-tech, but it's a very important component to high-tech manufacturing, which is you've got to have engineers who figure out why things go wrong. Right? You can't be producing nearly a million units of photocopiers per year unless you've got quick access to what the defects are, what the problems are. So you do have people in the Tower of Power who are basically looking at what's wrong. Why on the 100,000th copy did this photocopier jam? Why, when you switched from A4 paper to B4 paper, did it jam? So that's the kind of thing that these engineers here are doing. Here's some more testing engineers. Again, it doesn't look very high-tech, but it's an extremely important part of the product development and product testing reliability process. Here's a bunch of young men standing around being lectured to. Why? Because in the factory, there's a high school. These young men are getting a high school education on site. So part of knowledge-based competition is not only recruiting people, but training people. And the competition for good quality human resources in Japan has become so intense now that it's necessary, in fact, to offer a high school education to these technicians as an inducement to get them to join the firm, to come on board, and to be hardworking, loyal employees. This is also the factory. And right next to the traditional way of doing your drawings, you can see a CAD-CAM station here on the table to the right. And in fact, in order to make sure that people know how to draft, usually for the first year or two in the Tower of Power, you're not allowed to use the CAD-CAM equipment, because they want to make sure that people understand the fundamentals, which they get by using the drafting table. But my point here is this, too, is a factory. This, too, is part of the same factory. The most noteworthy feature of this particular transparency is you can see the woman engineer technician working behind this fellow in the foreground. More about that later. And this looks as much like a university environment as it does like a factory environment. But again, this too is in the Tower of Power. This too is part of this factory environment. And here you just see row upon row of computers. Everyone at their workstation has their own computer. Oftentimes they have several computers for doing different kinds of tasks. Again, this too is the same factory. And this is the face of modern manufacturing in Japan. Now I want to emphasize, these are not people geographically or organizationally removed from the factory. These are people who are geographically and organizationally integrated into the factory. Here was my boss the last time that I worked at this factory. This man is named Kondo, Mr. Kondo, and he was in charge of the training department. The training department was a department of eight full-time employees who did nothing at all except schedule training and education activities for the factory. They didn't deliver the courses. They did curriculum design and curriculum scheduling. Eight full-time people in this factory dealing strictly with training. In 1989, in this one factory, 90,000 hours, I'll say that again, 90,000 hours of off-the-job training was delivered in one factory in 1 year. Everyone knows that in a Japanese workplace, on-the-job training is more important than off-the-job training. And indeed, from my own experience, you get a heck of a lot more education on the job than you do off the job. Nevertheless, it's hard to quantify and measure how much on-the-job training occurs because it happens on the job. It's possible, however, to measure how much off-the-job training occurs. And in one factory, in 1 year, 90,000 hours of training were delivered to factory employees. That was not an unusual year. And in fact, year by year, the amount of factory-based, off-the-job training is increasing. That was 1989 figure. So for 1992, we can assume that we're up to 95,000 hours, perhaps even 100,000 hours. That was Mr. Kondo standing in front of whose pictures? The pictures of all the past factory managers. It's like walking into the boardroom of a corporation or a university and having up on the wall all the pictures, all the paintings of the past CEOs or university presidents. And in this factory, all the past factory managers have their picture on the wall. And I show this slide to emphasize a very important point, which is there is a very strong effort made, and this kind of summarizes, I hope, a lot of what you've been hearing me say about these slides. There's a very strong effort made to develop, nurture, and manage a factory culture. A factory culture. Because unless people feel strongly attached to their workplace, to their factory, they're not going to give their most. They're not going to give it everything they've got. And I think it's very important for us to understand that to have high-performing work organizations, you've got to have work organizations that are highly differentiated in terms of local culture, factory culture, office culture, meaningful at a local level. And there's a tremendous amount of effort that goes into this factory for precisely that purpose. And this is a kind of symbolic indication of that effort. All of the past factory managers have their picture up on the wall. And this is another one of my artistic photographs. So I just show you this as the last photograph for this set of slides from Kawasaki City, from Yanagicho Factory, from the Toshiba Corporation. Okay, let me try to give you some idea of what I think the importance of these slides were. I would argue that in Japan today, we see a fundamental and widespread differentiation, a structural and strategic differentiation of manufacturing facilities into two types. The classic factory, which is a high volume, low variety, highly standardized type of factory environment. The factories that we know so well, the ones that we try to avoid at all costs. And factories that are dedicated to product and process innovation, speeding up time to market, improving product development cycles. Factories that are competitive assets in a world where knowledge-based competition rules. These kinds of factories, the latter kinds of factories, the knowledge-intensive factories, have several important features, some of which I've talked about already. There is increasing productivity in manufacturing output. There are very different meanings attributed to work. So it's not simply the structure of work that's different, it's also the meaning that is attributed to those work structures which is different. And these kinds of features taken together constitute what I would call knowledge-based competition in Japan. Now let me give you some idea about how these features are changing. I think you've gotten the main thrust of my argument. These kinds of factories are increasing in number and importance. When I started my fieldwork research at Toshiba in 1985, people felt that roughly 50% of Toshiba's 27 factories in Japan were knowledge-based factories. Today, people will say 80%, perhaps even more, of Toshiba's factories are knowledge-based factories. So this drive towards knowledge-intensive manufacturing seems to be building. Part of the reason for this is mass production factories, the low end, the routine end of the manufacturing scale, is being shipped overseas, where East Asia, Southeast Asia, and yes, North America. Because, in fact, wages are less expensive overseas in markets like our own than they are in contemporary Japan. And that underscores what I would say is a very important point, which is knowledge-intensive factories such as these are high-cost factories. They only make sense if they're located within urban areas, close to the marketplace, close to changing consumer needs, filled with people with high levels of engineering and technical know-how, dedicated to the task of trying to get a variety of products to the market as quickly as possible. That's a high-cost manufacturing facility. And that's what manufacturing facilities are turning into Japan. Design and development platforms. And the routine assembly work is exported overseas. Now, especially in Europe, where I spent 4 years, there's a lot of concern about this changing direction in Japanese manufacturing. And Europe has put in a lot of laws against so-called screwdriver factories. Screwdriver factories are factories where simply you assemble products rather than develop products and actually manufacture products. And Europe has, therefore, local content laws, where 60% in Europe today of the value of a product has to be sourced locally. 60% of the value of the product has to come from Europe. The problem with that particular approach, however, is that people don't understand that even in Japan itself, if you look at this factory, it's a screwdriver factory. It's a screwdriver factory because it is so intensely focused on design and development work that it has subcontracted its own assembly work out to approximately 800 suppliers that supply components, sub-assemblies, and full assemblies to this factory for assembly, for screwdriver assembly. The point I'm trying to make is, even within Japan itself, this emphasis upon knowledge-based manufacturing, developmental intensivity, results in routine manufacturing operations being subordinated to subcontracting work or offshore work in Asia or North America. This intense push towards knowledge-based manufacturing and knowledge-based competition does have some bright lights for women in Japan. You noticed a few women in the slides. Approximately 15% of the engineers in this factory are women. Why? Because there is a severe labor shortage in Japan. And this means that skilled women have more opportunities in the workplace in Japan than they have ever had previously. And I don't simply mean assembly jobs. 15% of the engineers in this factory are women. And today, if you're a software engineer, increasingly in Japan, you're likely to be a woman. So I think there is a bright spot in that it's been discovered in the course of this kind of software and knowledge-intensive approach to manufacturing, that women can provide as much value as men. It's not manual work, it's mental work. And that actually is a revolution in the workplace in Japan, because as most of you know, for a long time, women have been either excluded from the workplace, or when they have been included in the workplace, they are paid substantially lower wages than men. But in this labor shortage, especially skilled labor shortage environment that we find in Japan today, there are more opportunities. I won't say equal opportunities, but there are more opportunities for women than ever before. Obviously, there's a growing emphasis on human resources training, and that goes along with this thrust towards knowledge-based competition in Japan. All right, let me ask you a set of questions now. How do you compete in a world of knowledge-intensive factories, design and development-intensive factories? What should you and I do when we fully understand what's happening in Japan? I think the choices are very few. Number one, we should imitate or withdraw. Now that's actually a fairly large dose of medicine. Because we're so used to thinking that it's the Japanese who imitate us that we don't have anything to imitate from them. But in fact, Japanese firms have known for a long time that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And if we want to develop the same kinds of knowledge intensivity in our manufacturing that Japanese firms have developed, we better start imitating what they do. And that will lead us to a second lesson, which is in imitation comes innovation. In fact, the very reason why we've tended to underestimate the Japanese is that we think that imitation is not an art. But if you can take something from as far away from Japan as North America, such as the width of the railroad gauges, the type of technology that was appropriate to grain from the prairies, the type of technology that was appropriate to the fiber, the cotton fiber that was grown in Louisiana, and transform that into technologies that are appropriate for Japan, you begin to understand that, in fact, imitation is far more than imitation. And it leads to innovation. And that's why I say we should imitate or withdraw, because in the very act of imitation, we will learn to be more innovative. And we will take what we see in Japan and make it work here, which is necessarily transforming it. Finally, I don't think that protectionism is an answer. Not at all. Why? Protectionism only works when fast follower strategies work. The whole idea of protectionism is it gives you a window of opportunity. It gives you a breathing space. It gives you some time to catch up. So protectionism might be a viable answer when fast follower strategies are viable. But the thrust of what I've been saying is fast follower strategies are not viable in these highly turbulent, highly technologically intensive industries that are the global industries today. No, you simply can't wait until Hitachi or Toshiba or Toyota develops their new generation of products. Because by the time you attempt to imitate those products, they've already brought out a new product to supersede the old one. Photocopiers, as you saw, was one of the main products in this factory. They are working two product generations out from the current product. Because we said the life cycle now for photocopiers in Japan is 6 months. So if you want to be able to keep up with the competition, if you want to be able to sell photocopiers with the likes of Canon and Mita and Matsushita and Riko, then you have to have at least one product ahead, already pretty much refined, ready to go into the marketplace, and you need to be working on the next generation beyond that so that you can respond in a timely and effective way. So that's the reality of competition in Japan today. Fast follower strategies don't work. So that's why I argue that protectionism is not an answer, because protectionism makes sense when you have a hope of catching up. It doesn't really make very good sense if you don't. I think I'm running long, aren't I? So let me try to summarize my main argument so far, and then leave some time for some questions. I believe that the nature of manufacturing competition is changing. It's changing worldwide, and it's changing in an easily identifiable direction. Increasingly knowledge-intensive products, increasingly knowledge-intensive manufacturing processes. And in this world, factories, that's why I put this emphasis upon factories, factories are the level of organization and the place where work has to be organized to be timely, effective, and fast. So I believe that factories are an effective, generic, and even strategic way to organize and manage in technology-intensive, highly turbulent industries. At the level of factory organization, there are very important differences with regards to the structure, process, and meaning of work at the level of factories. And that's why I would say factory culture is important. These differences, structural and meaning differences, are the result of strategic decisions taken by managers, but enacted by workers. So, knowledge-based competition, in my view, cannot be separated from the who, what, and why of the workplace. Who works in factories? What do they do? And why are they there? These are the key questions when we think about knowledge-based competition, which ultimately means factory-to-factory competition. So I'll conclude by stressing what I call the good K's, the good three K's, as opposed to the bad K's. You might remember that the Japanese have this kiken, kitsui, and kitanai. Factory work as dirty, difficult, and dangerous. But I would call knowledge-based competition is a combination of knowledge, general ideas about the world and how things work, know-how, the application of knowledge to particular products and processes, and then something I haven't talked about at all, but it's terribly important, knack. Knack, K-N-A-C-K. The knack for knowing how to do things. The knack for knowing how much torque to put on the screwdriver. The knack for knowing how the wire harness fits together. The knack for knowing how the work is supposed to go. And these three K's, I believe, are what characterize Japanese manufacturing today and are the key elements in knowledge-based competition. And I think unless we begin to understand these important differences with regards to the way work is conducted in Japan and the way that it's conducted elsewhere, we are faced with a situation where our industries and our companies and our very livelihoods will suffer, and where our standard of living will fall in the long run, and I think where basically our quality of life will deteriorate. So I think it's terribly important that we understand the reality of knowledge-based competition and we understand the reality of Japanese industrial success over the last 4 to 5 decades. Thank you very much. Yes.
Given your knowledge of North American culture, do you think we can reverse current trends?
The question was, can we reverse current trends in North America? Yes. Because, in fact, if you look at what Western observers of Japan were saying less than 100 years ago, when writing back, they went over there to sell some industrial product, and they'd write back to the head office, and they'd say, Japanese are lazy, they're inefficient, they'll never get off the farm, they don't understand industrial regimes, they basically are not the people that we have to worry about competitively. And so what I really am suggesting is the Japanese are not as productive as they are today because they're Japanese in some genetic or biological sense. They didn't happen to be this efficient. They worked very hard to get to this level of productivity. And that assumes that we can do it as well. It also assumes it will take some time. Dan? No. So the question was about the quality of life for the worker. The quality of life for a worker in a factory like this is quite good. They are, to use a kind of Western term, they form an industrial aristocracy, which is to say they have the best wages, the best benefits of any workers in Japan, which is true for workers in large firms. On the other hand, you don't get those benefits or those wages without full-hearted, full-bodied participation. And that's what the thrust, I think, of some of these slides were. That is, you are well taken care of, but in exchange, you are expected to contribute your utmost. The average work week is 50 hours a week. So everybody works 2 hours overtime a day. That's taken for granted. It's beyond the 50 hours when you really start counting overtime. You get to work early. I should have worn my uniform just to give you some idea of what it's like, but you see everybody's got a uniform. And when I was there, I had a uniform. Not because I was fooling anyone that I was actually Japanese, but it's part of this effort to manage the environment and to give a sense of identity and participation. The management of the symbolism of the workplace is very important. So if you want to pay people well, you need to expect a lot from them. And I think what you find is the workers themselves report a high level of satisfaction with their work in these kinds of factories. Why? Because the factory is geared towards innovation. And by comparison, they say, I could also work in one of the classic factories, high volume, low variety factories, where my work would be much more routine. So in fact, for them, this is work as a lab. Many of the slides from this factory make this factory look more like a university environment than a traditional manufacturing facility. And that kind of an environment is attractive. So I think, in fact, the concerns about the quality, the welfare, and the quality of life issues for Japanese workers are not so well directed towards this class of employee, workers in large companies in Japan. They're very well taken care of. They're highly trained. There's a lot of effort to motivate them and to get them to participate, and generally they do. The concern about quality of life issues might be more directed towards workers in small and medium-sized companies, which play a very important role in supplying these large firms that have turned into these design and development platforms. But that's not really the subject of today's discussion. So the question was about how do you deal with people's emotional or psychological needs in the workplace? Actually, the company pays a lot of attention to that, and most companies in Japan do, in the sense that they recognize that a happy worker is a productive worker. And, in fact, there is a fair amount of attention paid to psychological and emotional needs. I'll just give you one example. Three times in your life of working for this company, when you join, mid-career, and just before you retire, at company expense, you go away for a weekend out to a company lodge, and you have a weekend seminar on the meaning of life and work. Right? And the effort is to try to get employees to work through what employment means, what employment in this company means, what work means, how this relates to the rest of their life, and the issue is met straightforwardly. I think in general, the real key is as long as there are steady signs of improvement in productivity and profits hold up, output increases, you're part of a kind of win-win situation. You feel good about yourself, you feel good about your workmates, you feel good about the company. The real test would come if things began to turn down and all of this effort that you were making in the workplace was not rewarded. So that situation hasn't occurred. I mean, we are in a so-called post-bubble economy in Japan, where real estate values and stock share values have plummeted. But if you look at industrial indexes, the output figures for Japan and the productivity figures, Japan is still doing very well in the manufacturing sector. So there's a kind of psychology that you buy into. I mean, and the company, frankly, attempts to manage that. You can't get high performance without high involvement. And the company understands that and makes moves to try to deal with it. Yeah. The rate of unionization in Japan is probably higher than it is in, certainly higher than it is in the United States. Higher than it is in most of the Western countries. There is a big difference, however, that these are so-called company unions. It's not to say that they're not unions, and they have a tremendously important role to play in terms of bargaining at the company level with management with regards to wages, benefits, the content of work, the flow of work. But the relevant bargaining unit is at the company level. And since both labor and management at the company level see the advantage of having a vibrant, strong company, the presumption is that they will find ways to cooperate together for mutual benefit. So two questions. What about teams? Like in Sweden, is work organized around teams? And then in factory, in-house daycare facilities for women and their children. Yes, everything is done in teams. The basic unit of organization, the basic unit of work is the team. And obviously you get individual rewards and you are promoted as an individual, but your remuneration and your promotion and basically your well-being is always in the context of the team, the social group with which you interact. And that also relates back to that earlier question about their psychological well-being. I think one reason why it doesn't seem as if the individual is responding negatively under so much pressure is because everything is done in a social context with your workmates. And a lot of research has shown that employees in Japan develop very strong social affect with their workmates, and that's an important part of their attitude towards work. With regards to daycare facilities, in fact, the factory did offer daycare facilities for a number of years, which they subsequently have closed down. The main reason being 26 million people in Tokyo. Can you imagine trying to take your infant to the factory on public transportation? You can't. So since you can't take your infant to the factory on public transportation, there's no reason to offer daycare facilities in the factory. That's what they discovered. They thought if they opened daycare facilities, the mothers would flock in with their children. But in fact, unless you happen to live close to the factory and you could walk there, you would never take your infant to the factory on public transportation. I mean, the stories and pictures that you've seen about public transportation in Tokyo are real. In the morning when you ride, you are a sardine packed into a car. Yeah, it's we have an attitude in the West about companies should get lean and mean, flat hierarchies, and we think that's will solve most of our competitive problems. Actually, when we look at Japanese companies, they have very tall hierarchies. There's a lot of managers in the workplace, but these are not managers as you and I would normally use the term. These are average employees. We would say blue-collar employees. The Japanese would never use a pejorative term like blue-collar. These are employees who are managers. And in fact, when you look at the slogans on the wall, one of the common ones is, everyone a manager. Right? Because if you want to get this level of participation and involvement and identification with work that Japanese companies strive for, you've got to make everyone believe that they manage themselves and they motivate themselves. Because if you have external control, this system will not work. So there's a lot of management, if in the classic sense you mean people who are differentiated by rank from others. But it's not management in the classic sense of we versus they, manager versus labor. It's managers actually in the sense of meritocracy, because you become a manager by demonstrating to everyone that you're the best at what you do. And in fact, in terms of actually the grade, the pay grades for higher management in the factory, roughly 20% of managers in this factory came up from the shop floor. Well, another aspect of this kind of the three good K's, the knowledge, know-how, and knack, is that you can't accumulate knowledge, know-how, and knack if people move around a lot or move around too much. And in fact, This will make it sound like it's a prison camp, but it really should be just the opposite. The only people who leave this factory are the factory managers. That's why you get your picture on the wall. You got out. No. You're hired in this company, and if you happen to be sent to this factory for work, you're likely to retire from this factory. That's true for engineers as well as line workers. You spend your whole career in this factory, which means you know the products, you know the technology, you know the processes, you know everybody that you need to know in order to get the job done. And because they also know you, and they also know that we're in this endeavor together, and our future is in this factory, they understand that they have to cooperate. Well, I think it's a good question, and it's a difficult one to deal with in a short period of time. It certainly has brought Japan the highest standard of living in the world, the highest per capita income in the world, a rapid recovery from utter physical and psychological devastation in World War II. So if you want to understand the social and economic consequences of this model of organization and manufacturing for Japan, it's brought great success to Japan. And brought Japan, you might say, to the pinnacle of material well-being as we measure that in the world today. It also has come largely in terms of what the market for Japanese goods are. The markets are mostly internal. We fail to recognize this sufficiently, which is we think that Japan is an export-led economy. If you look over the last 100 years of Japanese economic growth, actually for roughly 80 years of the last 100, Japan has run a trade deficit with the rest of the world. It's only been since the 1970s, with the world petroleum crises, that the Japanese have begun to consistently export more than they import. And the growth has occurred largely internally. The domestic market has been the major driving force in Japanese economic growth. Now, a relatively resource-poor country. So this economic growth and improvement in social and material well-being at home has come through the extensive exploitation of resources that are found outside of Japan. There's no doubt about that. But in terms of what the story is, in terms of improving the standard of living and material and social well-being in Japan, I don't think anyone could argue with the fact that Japan has come from being a relatively backward, poor, poorly nourished, relatively high levels of fertility and mortality, to a nation today that can be considered to be modern or even postmodern. Well, as I said, I think there is a very critical issue here, which is to say, in knowledge-based competition, fast to market, the right product at the right time, in the right amount, with the right features, is going to sell. And it's a question of, will that product be a product that a company in this country manufactures or a company in a different country manufactures? Unless you close off the relatively free flow of products, you're not going to prevent this kind of knowledge-based competition from occurring.
One last question, right here.
Question was, can I comment on the current status of the fifth generation computer product project? As I understand, the project has been recently disbanded, the end of its funding cycle. It wasn't nearly as successful as many people thought it would be. But I think, in fact, the idea in government circles in Japan is not that these projects need to be successful in the sense of actually producing a fifth-generation computer. They are successful if they move the state-of-the-art forward, if they diffuse knowledge and capability among a larger set of users, if it improves the current ability to provide information, processing information using products. And I think in that sense, the fifth generation project was successful. And Feigenbaum, when he wrote his book about fifth generation project, you know, he said, even if Japan only accomplishes 10% of what they've set out to do in the fifth generation project, it will be a success.